Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring the stories that make the incredible world of tech and venture tick. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to the founders, investors, and ecosystem operators trying to make a dent in the future. Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I'm super excited to have with me Sidhi Mittal. Sidhi is the co-founder of Why Hangry, a venture delivering chefs to your doorstep, which he launched in 2019 alongside Hainan Zhang. Sidhi is a computer scientist turned investment banker, having spent more than 5 years on the trading floor, ultimately managing $500 million in risk assets before entering the world of startups with Why Hangry. She's a professional Bollywood dancer, an American in the UK, and successfully navigated the Dragon's Den. Sidhi, welcome to the show. I'm really excited to have you here today.
Thanks so much, Arish. I'm very excited to be here.
Amazing. So look, before we kick off with kind of the questions that I had for you, one of the reasons it's taken a bit of time for us to actually get some time in the diary to record this is because really excited that Why Hangry has joined the YCOM accelerator program and is currently a cohort member. So I'd love for you to just kind of explain a little bit of what that whirlwind has been like for our listeners.
Absolutely. So very excited to be a part of Y Combinator. Actually, when we applied at 11 a.m. London time, and then the deadline was 6 a.m. the next day. So we didn't want to waste any time on this application because we were like, look, we're busy building a business, whatever, not even sure we want to do it. And I guess like that last minute application worked. We did take a day to accept, but yeah, now really, really glad we did. What that looks like is we started our cohort this June. I think generally overall, away from sort of the brand and the fact that like startups go on to raise better rounds and all this stuff, on like a very personal founder level, feels like people are asking you what's not working. And we have on a weekly basis been pushed really hard to do better and bigger things. And I think as a founder, just going in and being super vulnerable and being surrounded by really smart people and knowing that, I guess, statistically, a lot of founders end up making it after YC and just seeing that personal progress has been awesome. So yeah, really, really glad we're part of this. And yeah, feels like a privilege to kind of be a part of the cohort, but also just to be pushed the way we have been pushed.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting way of thinking about it, right? What's not working? Because obviously, as founders, we all kind of tend to fixate on, you know, our growth is going in the right direction, or we've hired the right people, or the, you know, the engineering is working, or whatever it is. And we lose sight of what isn't working, which could bring the business kind of down, or what would need to be fixed to scale efficiently. And I think to your point, that vulnerability is definitely something that, I mean, I certainly look for when I'm working with founders or even as an investor, because you want to know that the person you're working with has a self-awareness that not everything is perfect and there are things that may need fixing. But look, I'd love for you to actually expand on your background and journey a little more. Right? Having moved from computer science to trading to in-home dining is quite the career path, right? What triggered those interests and those moves?
Absolutely. So very quick background. I was born and brought up in India. My father is an entrepreneur or a businessman in India. That's like a bit more, rough and tough. It's not as glorious as saying entrepreneur. My mom, like super clever, always like the topper in class. I ended up going to Columbia to do computer science, where I majored in artificial intelligence. All through my sort of college, I really ended up Bollywood dancing and doing like it competitively. And my parents weren't really happy at that time. But to me, sort of building a dance team and like getting to competitions and fundraising was just really exciting. That's actually how I got a job on a trading floor in New York, because they were like, right, you're obviously like sort of hacky or entrepreneurial enough to run this dance team, and you're a computer science major, great. Here's a job on a trading floor. I thought that was like the best thing ever, because at that point, grass is greener on the other side. I thought being a developer was very micro. I wanted to do like, see the world. And I felt like trading exposed me to countries and their problems and really big macro variables that seem to influence this thing called markets. Anyway, got on the trading floor, absolutely loved it. Like, I think there was like a very much of a personality fit where they wanted someone loud and brash. And I was like, this is great. That's exactly who I am. Best job in the world. Got deported to London. issues with visa, not really deported, but I would have been. And I think, so basically my journey started in London, did that 4 or 5 years, thought it was the best job in the world. Genuinely, I thought, wow, I'm getting paid to play with like millions and millions of dollars and just actually just learn this is insane. But I think towards sort of like 4 or 5 years in, I couldn't remove this nagging feeling. There's something else I'm meant to be building in this world. I just felt like the higher my paycheck got, my happiness didn't match that. And then I think I kind of attribute that to purpose, where you can make all the money in the world, but if like it's not just money that makes you happy, then you're just going to be quite miserable. So I call it a first world problem. I got really lucky where I was a trader on the trading floor. Heinen joined from GS, like this really clever girl who was going to be leading the institutional sales for sort of Germany hedge funds. We became really good friends. And actually, like, we just bonded like really hard over the fact that like our upbringing was very similar. She's like German, Chinese. We always came from families where you just spend so much time with friends and family at home. And we were just like, yeah, like awesome. Actually, work is a little bit shit too. I mean, it's just like not where we're at. And I think in that conversation, we realized, yeah, Why Hangry just as an idea was very natural to us, because not only we had grown up with a lot of great home cooked food at home, we also were around chefs or cooks. And just in London, London is a lot more cold. Everyone goes out to a restaurant, and we miss the sense of people, friends at home, great food. And together, both of us were like, wow, let's just do it. Why not? Let's bring that concept to London. When we did a little bit of research, we also realized, obviously, that there was a big gap. It wasn't as accessible at all. People didn't really have private chefs, or that was just something that really, really the ultra rich did. So I think all that came together quite quickly, which kind of launched into our Why Hangry journey together. And I guess that's how I made the leap from trading into private chefs, which seems really crazy, but it's not once you factor in sort of the upbringing and meeting a co-founder who very naturally understood the concept herself and our own needs. So we build this for ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think that co-founder fit is really important. We're going to talk about that a little bit down the track. But I think, you know, too many businesses don't necessarily think through the kind of co-founder dynamics early on enough. And, you know, there's that old trope that you're, you know, if you're launching a business, you're going to be married to the business, married to your co-founder. You need to have that, you know, dynamic between you that you are really, you know, really able to kind of do it together. One of the things you said there, which I think is really important, is that payoff or trade-off between paycheck versus happiness and purpose. It's a really... I think it's something that a lot of people have talked about over the last decade, maybe more. But I think I feel, coming from a kind of Asian background myself, obviously an Indian background myself, I feel like it is something that Southeast Asia has a bit more, is a bit more attuned to, right? We're very, very close to that. Money is not the purpose or the meaning. It may be a means to an end, but it isn't the end in and of itself. And I think that's, you know, that's a really important factor when you're launching a business, is figuring out what is your purpose and will it make you happy? Because ultimately, if you're going to do something, it should make you happy. Like, there will be moments of stress. There will be moments of anxiety. There will be moments where it feels like, you know, gosh, I wish I'd done something completely different. But ultimately, like, if you're getting up every day to do something, it should make you happy as far as possible, right? So I think that's super important. So actually, look, this pod is called Nothing Ventured for a reason, and it'd be remiss of me if we didn't talk a little bit about some of the punts you've taken, where you've, you know, taken on a challenge or done something that you weren't sure was going to pan out. Tell me how you thought through the risk, the sort of challenges you faced, and what the outcome and learnings were, because I think that's a really important insight for me into kind of the minds of founders in general.
Yeah, I think definitely. And maybe there's some two quick instances, because I think follow on from what you said, the biggest one was quitting to do our own startup. I think that was like the biggest punt, and we didn't know what it was going to look like. I think ultimately, and this is like the quick short first example, but ultimately it came down to, did we have people in our lives that supported this jump? And if we were not to succeed, what was our fallback going to be? And I think it actually took a very long time to get there. Like mentally we tormented ourselves, oh, we're not gonna stop our paycheck, etc. But I think what it comes down to is, I did have savings, so did Heinen. we did have families that would have supported us if we ran out of savings and like crashed and burned. And we needed our families to say, it's okay, we're with you. And once all of that decided, we were like, look, everything else is superficial because it feels like we are too worried about what people might think of our failure, and that is irrelevant. So I think that's like the first example. But I think, I guess, when we started sort of our startup journey, honestly, with like COVID hit so close to our origins where it all feels insane. And it's difficult to pick up moments. And I feel like there are just quite a few. Only a couple months into starting Why Hangry, COVID happened, which meant everything went in lockdown and we actually stopped operating for like a total of 2 or 3 months. Hayden moved into my place because I was like, dude, you're alone in London. Just come live with me and my boyfriend, that's actually who is my husband now. And then he actually got COVID immediately after. So we were like three of us trapped in this tiny little apartment. And actually over the 3 months, we were like, look, we've quit our jobs. Why Hangry still makes sense, but we can't do it right now. And we decided to do what we could in that moment, which was grow our Instagram followers, because what we realized very quickly was marketing spend dropped from $3 to $4 per user acquisition on Instagram to like pennies, like 10 cents. Like it was so easy. So we were daily doing live cooking classes, even though I hate cooking. Like I fundamentally hate cooking, and we almost burnt our kitchen down. Like we have a live Instagram video of a fire in the kitchen because we're so terrible. Like we forgot about it and it started, it was like a big fire. It was insane. But look, what all we were doing was optimizing for the variables we could. And I just remember in those 3 months, we started virtual classes. We also started batch cooking delivery because we knew that we will get through this and then we will get back on track. And I think obviously then the next thing here is like then Dragon's Den happened, and it wasn't very planned that we would air on Dragon's Den or we should apply. But I think how we approach all of these things is, look, we got to take all the shots we're given in life. And whether like we can't preempt what the what ends up happening, but what we can do is choose to take each of those shots. And yeah, I guess that's what sort of how we approach situations where we have no clue what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, right? So I think first off the bat, like having the family and the ability to be able to take that risk is something that I've thought through quite a lot. And I have a very similar kind of situation. I would say, like, if everything went, you know, completely the wrong way and I lost my house, I'd be able to go and, you know, camp out at my parents' place for the next whatever period of time, right? And then get back on my feet. I think one of the things I'm very conscious about is there are lots of people out there that just don't have that privilege. And that's a huge kind of barrier to entrepreneurialism, right? So the ability to take the risk, knowing that even like if you stake 500 quid on buying some candles or whatever and setting up an e-com store, you know, that 500 quid isn't going to ruin you it's a privilege, but it's something that that we need to overcome, right? We need to figure out a way of getting more people into that entrepreneurial kind of journey. And I think the second thing you said there, which was really relevant, was to think that, you know, thinking about what others think is irrelevant, right? You've got to shed any shame and shame is a massive kind of issue, I think, within Asian cultures, right? Like the whole, you're not a banker, you're not an accountant, you're not a doctor, you're not, you know, you're not doing something that would make the parents proud. And it's really weird because, as you say, right, a lot of us come from entrepreneurial families, but there is this really kind of skewed adverse attitude towards risk taking, which I find that dynamic really, really bizarre. But the thing that I'd really like to kind of understand, or not even understand, but like just to dig into a bit further, is, as you said, right, the 2 to 3 months were shut down, your marketing, you know, you basically sat there and said, right, what can we do to push Why Hangry forward, even though we can't deliver a service, right? Like, how did you think through that? Did you kind of do the research? Did you go in and look at the data around the marketing spend? Did you see whether there were people kind of just waiting in the sidelines looking for something to follow on Instagram? Like, how did you go through the process of figuring out this is the thing that we should look at?
While you were asking that question, I was obviously thinking through it, and it's actually a lot easier. The answer is actually very simple. Just do it. And that's what we did. Because the thing is, data comes after a lot of people have done stuff. So we didn't know marketing dollars had gone down. That's a story I tell now. But we felt it. We did the first couple of classes because there were thousands joining every day. It was like, dude, what's going on? Let's just do more. And then it's like after 7 days, when you continue doing more because something's working, you're like, wait, let's just quickly analyze the data. Holy hell, like that's actually what the data says. And actually at every single point, what Hylan and I personally think we're very good at is we're very speedy. If you say something, we'll just go do it. And I think an example of that is why Hangry started, because we created a PDF and we wrote down dishes she and I liked. And then we sent it to our friends and we were like, you can book a chef, pick 3 dishes. That's the cost. We'll do the rest. And it was a PDF. And I think and that was the same day we were like, let's do it. We sent out this PDF. We created a calendar. I started booking friends in because we were like, we're going to make these calls and we're going to book them in. So I think we have just valued like speed and just doing. Because to be honest, like if you have time to overthink sometimes, you'll talk yourself out of it. Like if we had researched, would people want virtual classes, the time would have passed because there was actually only a 2-month window where people wanted to cook. And then everyone was like, I hate cooking now because I've done too much of it. So, and we saw the full wave, and then we started doing delivery because we were like, great, actually now you're bored. Because we felt it after a month of cooking ourselves. I was like, I will kill myself if I do this again 2 times a day. I definitely cannot go through this. So I think, the answer I'm trying to get to is, in the moment where you have no idea what you should be doing, pick up on like what your gut says and just start doing really quickly, because the results you get speak a lot more than surveys. And I think that's one more thing we do at WhyHangry, where like I just don't even believe in surveys. I'm like, what people say and do is completely different. You're gonna just build something, just do something, and how people react to it is the truth. Try to sell them something. If they're not going to pay you £10 for it, don't go building something that they might in the future kind of sort of pay £10. So I think that's kind of how we thought about it.
Yeah, that's really insightful, because that's the kind of always be shipping, always be testing, right? Like a startup is just a series of experiments. And I think that's, in today's world, it's something that we've somewhat forgotten, because I guess the cost of engineering has dropped so low, the cost of kind of, you know, compute power, the ability to go out there and actually try and test something has become so low that actually we've stopped doing it, because it's so easy to build something and just say, right, okay, well, this is something someone wants. So I think that we had a conversation with a guy called Jonathan Sun, who has a sort of alt finance business called Horizon VC. And, you know, he talks a lot about prototyping. So really, what is a minimal sort of thing that you can do to kind of get off the ground? And I think that's exactly what you're saying, you know, and throughout the startup journey, I guess there are lots and lots of times where you will pick that up again and do that again, right? It isn't always about building the product or shipping the product. It's also about just those small tests throughout. One of the things that I think, you know, we kind of touched on earlier, but I think it'd be really great to dig into a bit further is, how do you and Hylan kind of complement each other as co-founders? Because I'm really interested in understanding the dynamic there, and also how much do you support each other? Because I kind of feel like, you know, you talked about it earlier, you know, she came and stayed with you during lockdown, you're now married, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. How does that relationship work? How do you guys kind of navigate the co-founding kind of journey?
Yeah, and I think like just being very honest, she is one of my closest friends now. And we say that in the same breath, but we also admit that this is like probably the most intense relationship in our lives. Like we have partners individually, like actually all 4 of us are friends also, which is really nice. And we actually quite separate sometimes the private and the business, but we can't, it's all linked. But it's so intense on like a personal level, because yeah, I just think life does not equip you for that kind of relationship. I think before I talk more about that, I think generally we have a lot of shared values, and we have a lot of shared kind of core belief systems that allows us to be, I think, like a really good match. That being said, we have very offsetting skills. So we both obviously believe in the idea. We both believe in speed of execution. We believe in doing and not saying. So I think that is like the fundamental of like what's same between us. What's different is I am like, I see myself, I do more product, she does more growth. And I think that just complements our skill sets. Like I did computer science. I like was a trader. Whereas for her, like she was in sales. She would just pick up the call, like make that sale. She also is the more natural host. Like her knowledge of food and wine is like so much superior. Whereas I sit there and I'm like, what about the vegetarian options? Because I'm vegetarian. And I think this sort of perfect blend of like someone being a foodie and into wine, whereas the other person just like thinking a lot more product, but then like sort of allows us to come together from different ways. And I think obviously like once we know roughly how we complement each other and the fact that our core is very similar, it works really, really well. And I think we can see that on a daily basis where it's like, oh, that thing came up. Oh, like that's you. Like you're so much better at copywriting, like, or writing, like you pick that up. Oh, that thing. Oh, I'll pick that up because actually I'll just do it a lot quicker. That's my skill set. So I think the split is just very natural. But I think we have, like, I think we also, for a couple months had a business coach because we realized that for co-founders and such an intense relationship, we wanted someone to help us think through. And actually it was very business focused. It's like, cool, these are the goals. And then some stuff comes up if it needs to, right? Like a little bit of friction. And that hugely helps because people need to talk about stuff when it's like a friction or you guys are not agreeing. But if someone can help you do that in 1 hour, whereas you will do that in 10 hours, you're saving 9 hours. So we chose to pay for a business coach to save time because that's not our job to do it as quickly. And actually, like, we might do it again. It's just like when things get so intense, we're like, wow, let's just like, yeah, get someone to like, it's like kind of cleaning your house and getting a cleaner. And it's like, we're like, awesome, someone to just like unpack a lot of that stuff. So I feel like, yeah, there is a lot there, but yeah, we're super close. I think we want to better ourselves and we're very offsetting skills, yet similar core belief.
Yeah, and I think that's the absolute critical point, right? Is to have skills that complement each other without overlapping. Because the problem is if you overlap, then there's more friction because one of you is constantly going to feel like, well, the other person is taking the lead on this, but I feel I could do it. Why aren't I doing it, right? And it's very hard to then carve out, like, how do I share that? And I think, you know, you put it really well. It's that typical kind of business focused versus product focused kind of mix. And that seems to be the best way of moving forward. I think it's really interesting you talked about coaching because one of our previous guests, who I think you know as well, Janat Shah Rajan, has just qualified as a coach, and she's going to be writing some material for us on Nothing Ventured as well. And her first piece is actually going to be about coaching. And one of the things that I'm really, really passionate about is understanding that, you know, whether founders have that bit of that coachability, right? Whether they have the open-mindedness and the growth mindset to the extent that they are willing to be put in a room and coach through something, even if that is uncomfortable. And to your point, if you don't do that, then you're actually not saving money because it's costing you time, right? And I think that's the other thing that is really important for all founders to realize is that time is actually your most valuable resource. Money buys you time, and that's what it's there for. And I think that's a very difficult heuristic for a lot of founders to come across because they're used to doing it themselves, right? And I think that's the thing that you've got to unlearn to then be able to progress forward. Do you agree with that?
I feel like we just found like the marketing messaging for coaches that they should use more often. We're saving you time and money.
Right. Okay. Don't get me started because that if I launch another business, I think my wife will potentially kick me out of the flat. But look, okay. So what are the things? I'm a finance guy. I come from a finance background. I'm really always intrigued to understand what founders and what businesses kind of track within their venture to see kind of whether they're going in the right direction. So what is it that you track relentlessly at Why Hangry, and why do you track those particular things?
Oh God, everything. We track everything. And I think this evolves because our dashboards become way more complicated and it's like, oh gosh, it takes a while to update it and stuff. But just like the top level view, we track, for example, what our core KPI is. So just like Airbnb, that's like a two-sided marketplace for us. Number of bookings tells us how relevant we are to customers and chefs both. So that's our core top line KPI. Obviously, how much revenue we are generating weekly is like right below it. So those two things are just like, you need to know at every single second what that is. Then we track sort of pyramid KPIs, which are essentially just saying, if every week we get into a room and say, how can we increase the number of bookings? That's a bit of like a random conversation to have every week. It's like, what? Where do we start? Whereas we track pyramid KPIs, like what are little metrics that actually feed into bookings? And this could be stuff like how many customers are coming back to our website, or sorry, how many people are doing date searches, or I think a lot of different metrics. And then on, and for us, actually, a huge part is word of mouth, because at every single dinner party, six people at a dinner party, and that's like a very natural channel. So that's 50% for us. So what we then track is how many hosts are sending guest invites, how many guests are coming back on our platform. We track like, wow, okay, cool. How many people said they heard about us, right? So I think a lot of this stuff, which ultimately goes back into increasing bookings and revenue, but that's, I would say, like the main dashboard. We also have a weekly dump of sort of our operational booking related analytics. So things like what weekday, what weekend, what are people choosing? What kind of cuisines they're choosing? We're trying to understand, wow, what add-ons did people pick? And it's like, wow, this add-on did really well this week. Then we're, because actually, as you start looking at all these metrics, it's essentially all the bookings and what people have done to understand patterns. And that helps us just like next week amend stuff quite quickly, because we're like, wow, just didn't know. This week, Mexicans just gone crazy. What was it? Was it like the placement of it? Or was it like we made a better dish? And I think all this stuff just helps us become better. And then probably the third most important sort of dashboard is your marketing, your paid acquisition channels, because that's where dollar is actually going out. And you want to say exactly how much money did we spend, and how much was the bookings? Did we make it back in the first one, which we usually do? And it's like, oh, this week this went wrong, or this week this was great. Let's like change or switch. So those are the three sort of key dashboards we have and like we look at.
Yeah, all of those make sense. They're all things that I've tracked in the past in similar sort of businesses. But, you know, I think what's really interesting is it's a bit kind of OKR-ish, right? So you have the headline objective is bookings and, you know, revenue as a function of bookings. And then underneath that, you have all these sort of mini KPIs, as you say, that kind of that feed into that number, right? So it's not enough to know that bookings are increasing. Why are bookings increasing? Are they increasing because you've got more people coming onto platform, or the same people booking again on platform? And obviously you want both of those things, but actually the best thing to have is people, you know, booking again on platform and then referring on, because that means you're lowering your cost of acquisition and increasing, you know, your lifetime value across the customers. So I think that's really valuable. So anyone out there listening who's got a marketplace venture, you heard it here, you know, these are the things you should be tracking. So a bit of a spoiler now. So talk us through the motivation for going on the Den. Well, I say a spoiler, I think it's come out now, but what were the motivations for going on the Dragon's Den, and the experience of working with not just one but two dragons? Was it worth it?
Motivation for, let's say, applying. So firstly, we got scouted to apply. Someone was like, hey, do you want to? We're like, sure. I think very much like the YC app, where we don't even know we're gonna get in, but we're gonna take the shot, we're gonna apply. Then we got in, we made it onto the screening day. A lot of startups actually then don't make it to the actual airing. We then made it. So actually all the way through, we were just like, dude, if we make it, that's great. And if we don't, I mean, like, whatever, but we're going to take the shot anyway. So that was kind of our like thinking through a lot of things, and it applies to Dragon's Den. I think the second part of that was like, how was our experience? I think two parts on the day, amazing. Like, it was such an intense day. And there was a lot of prep, etc. But, and to be fair to the dragons in the den, we actually were in the den for like 2.5 hours worth of questions. It's super intense, and people are not very friendly, or not at the beginning 30 minutes at least. And it really, like, it was really cool, because when you come out of it, you're like, actually, we did pretty great. And obviously, we got offers from Peter and Tej, and we accepted it. We actually didn't go through with the offer. And it is simply because, after you get off Dragon's Den, you obviously then get to speak to dragons about, like, does this make sense for both parties? And it just wasn't a fit. And we didn't accept, like, we didn't accept the investment off screen. So can't really talk about working with them. But I would say the overall yeah, experience was like, obviously it's like a great TV show. It's run really well. And like, they do a lot of due diligence. Like the number of documents we submitted was probably more than when we raised our pre-seed round. Like it was insane.
But I think that's really interesting, because I think that's partly the difference between pitching on Dragon's Den versus pitching for more traditional, I say traditional venture capital or angels, right? Because the sort of businesses that go on Dragon Den tend to be a very different growth perspective than, say, Why Hungry, right? So Why Hungry is going down a venture growth path, whereas Dragon's Den, I think, from what I can tell, tends to lend itself a bit better to more stable, organic growth-led businesses, especially where the expectation is that investors will be very hands-on, whereas obviously, like with Why Hungry and with other venture-backed businesses, your expectation is, yeah, like you're an investor, feel free to give us, you know, advice or connections or whatever, but you're not going to run our business. Like that is a very, very different thing to what venture-backed businesses go through. And I think the other thing that's really interesting there is the fact that having received the investment or received the investment deal, let's say on the Den, once you got out of the Den and got into the deeper conversations and the more due diligence and all the rest of it, that the deal actually didn't then kind of go forward. Because actually, from the reading that I've done, that seems to be the case in quite a lot of instances, right? Like it's all great. You get the offer on the Den, but once you get into it thereafter, it often falls over, but it often doesn't make sense for both parties, right? So I'm really glad. I have to be honest, I kind of feel like that was probably the better outcome for you guys. I really say that with zero kind of skin in that game, but it feels like if you had have taken it, it may have taken you down a different path.
Oh, absolutely. And I think we were always very clear from the beginning that we are going to be like a very, very big business. And actually, like I think very candidly, when we went to Dragon's Den, we even reduced our projections of 5 years. We made ourselves seem like a lot more of a stable, no-brainer, payback kind of business, even though that's not the business we want to build, because otherwise we would have looked so ridiculous that we could have just anticipated the questions. That being said, 5 to 8% of our customers, maybe it's more, actually come to us now because they heard us on Dragon's Den. And I think as like a founder, it was just like, felt like a win in a year of COVID where everything was so difficult that you just couldn't do anything. So I feel like, it was like a very good outcome for us.
100%. I mean, I think it's marketing that you can't buy. It's a bit like when founders go on crowdfunding platforms at the end of the day, you know, it gives access to a whole plethora of clients that customers that you may not have been focused on otherwise. So just as we round off, I'd love to hear what you're excited about in 2022. Now we're out of kind of the main, you know, I say the main, the 2 years of really kind of heavy COVID restrictions. What are you excited about for 2022? Obviously, you've got Y Combinator in the mix as well. And what is next for the business and for you?
Yes, so excited about so many things. I guess trying to put some thoughts into context. So Why Hungry is like a marketplace where you can book a private chef at home, and we make it quite easy and affordable, same prices as at a restaurant. And I think we, our initial model was very much logistics heavy, where we actually, once you book the order and you can instantly kind of place on our website, it's all quite easy and quick. We do the groceries, we send you the menus, and we do all of the stuff together. However, we also see that there is a tech side where we can actually start to be more of a tech platform. We allow chefs to do sort of their own menus, and we actually align ourselves to that. And that actually allows us to not only just make this something that's quite affordable and alternate to a restaurant, but we can now also say, look, you can book a master chef because you had a special occasion, and like that's insane. Like, why not? Because access to all kinds of chefs is missing, really. So, for example, we've already launched our beta, we've already started doing master chef. chefs. Like, there are a lot of master chefs you can book on Why Hungry. And I think we are kind of moving more from a operations logistics company to a tech company and platform that not only supports chefs get higher income and support them through that full sort of phase, but it also allows us to serve the customer a lot better by saying, look, it doesn't matter what kind of chef or for what, everything is now available at Why Hungry. And I think that's like a really exciting change for us, because obviously anything that's a lot more tech or only tech is a lot more scalable. And I think we have, as first-time founders, we started down one route, and now that we've like uncovered such a big demographic, because we did the logistics, we can now sort of just like move them back to sort of like this tech bit of our platform. And just as a stat, like 70% of our customers have never used a private chef before. So we are creating a category. It's huge. Like, people say, oh, I just never knew how to, I would have never booked it, this is awesome. Now that I've done it, wow, I'll totally do it again. And we see that come through in stats. So I think this like shift, yeah, it's very exciting. It's also like increases our mission about, yeah, like really being able to empower these chefs, like earn more money, like support them through this journey and actually get more people doing this. So it's like aligning the efforts and becoming more of a tech company. So I think that's like the one big, big, big thing we're excited about.
Amazing. I mean, as a customer myself, I can definitely say, A, I'd never done it before. B, and to be honest, I'd only ever really thought about private chefs in the context of heading to a villa in Bali or in, you know, or sitting in Kenya or sitting in India or you know, lower cost environments where, you know, it's ubiquitous and it's easy. But actually having a chef come to your home is a really interesting and different experience. And in fact, whilst it wasn't a Why Hungry chef, my cousin turned 50 over the weekend recently, and there was about a dozen of us at her home, and they invited a private chef who was actually a vegetarian. Well, she cooked us a full vegetarian meal. And it just meant that there was no stress for her, right? Like for my cousin, she was just able to enjoy the evening without having to think about any of the kind of logistics or prep or anything else like that. And I think it just unlocks a really interesting category in a post-COVID or a intra-COVID time, right? Where people are less enthusiastic about going out all the time, are still wanting to have that experience, want to reconnect with the people in their lives that they've had to stay away from or apart from for the last couple of years, just because, you know, they weren't in their bubble or they weren't, you know, they weren't in the country because they live in another country or whatever it is. And now you've got the opportunity to have a restaurant-like experience in your home. I think it's really wonderful. So Siddhi, look, thank you so much for joining me here today. It's been absolutely lovely having you participate in this conversation. For our listeners, where can they find you? Are you on Twitter? Are you on LinkedIn? Where's the best place for them to find you online?
Yeah, definitely. On a Twitter, I'm more of a watcher, but definitely you can find me on Twitter, smiddle23, or LinkedIn. Yes, definitely. Or Instagram. But I think LinkedIn's like probably the most preferable channel. Yes.
Amazing. Siddhi, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Aris, thank you so much for everything. I had such a great time.
Amazing. Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. Follow us on social and at nothingventured.tech to make sure you never miss another episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving us 5 stars on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners to understand the topics and guests that they'd like to hear about and from most. Drop us a message via the links in the show notes, and thanks again for your support.